Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman of Vocalo.org, 89.5 FM.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
Our topic today is the impressive U.S. Army Corps of Engineers storm risk reduction work being done in the area of New Orleans.
In 2006, following the damage done by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, Congress authorized the Corps of Engineers to begin a number of projects designed to reduce the risk to the New Orleans metropolitan area from a 100-year storm. One of the largest projects in the plan is the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal Lakebourne Surge Reduction Project, or IHNC Surge Barrier for short.
It is the largest surge barrier of its kind in the world, stretching about 2 miles across the Gulf Intercoastal Waterway and the Mississippi River outlet. Its purpose is to reduce the risk of storm surge from the Gulf of Mexico and Lake Bourne, protecting some of the most vulnerable areas in the region, including New Orleans East, New Orleans Metro, the Ninth Ward, and St. Bernard Parish. It is the largest design-build civil works project that the Corps has ever built, estimated to cost about $1.3 billion.
Here to discuss this important topic is Rick Kendrick, who's Chief Program Executive for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Hurricane Protection Office in New Orleans. The Hurricane Protection Office is overseeing approximately $5.9 billion of risk reduction construction projects in southeast Louisiana, including the IHNC Surge Barrier. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
To begin with, can you tell us a little bit more about storm surges, particularly during Katrina, and what they are and how they damage the region?
Sure. You know, as everybody, a lot of people knows, is when Katrina came through, Hurricane Katrina in particular, we had a huge storm surge. In fact, it came in just south of New Orleans itself, about an hour south, ended up hitting the brunt of the storm, doing a lot of damage to New Orleans and also to the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, bringing in surges as high as 28 feet. A surge is basically the water, storm elevation, or the actual elevation of the ocean rose 28 feet, and we had on top of that waves as much as 55 feet above that. So a huge storm came in affecting the Gulf Coast from New Orleans all the way through Mississippi. The other thing is it also caused a lot of flooding, some overtopping the walls here.
And the IHNC surge barrier, what is it? How does it work? How big is it? How is it protection against this in the future?
Okay, well, what happens is the storm came in from the eastern side in this particular case, okay? And if you've been through New Orleans, what you'll find is we have the IHNC is the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal. It's a canal that runs really from the eastern side of the coast of New Orleans. It looks like a funnel coming in. You got land on both sides, goes into the middle, takes you all the way through to Lake Pontchartrain. If you go to the end and take a right, takes you to Lake Pontchartrain. If you go to the end and take a left, takes you back to the Mississippi River through a lock, okay? And so what the IHNC surge barrier does is on the Lake Bourne side, it really puts a barrier in the water. It's about 2 miles across in what I called the funnel earlier before we get this piece. It puts a barrier in that will prevent that flood water from going into the heart of the city. Because a big part of the Katrina storm, the surge came in through that Inner Harbor Canal, and it was able to flood basically what we call, using a Dutch term, polders or regions or areas or basins. It flooded the St. Bernard Basin from there, which is down to the south. It flooded the New Orleans East Basin, which is up to the north, and the New Orleans Metro area, which is where some of the downtown areas are, which is off to the west side of the canal. So it actually affected a big population to that area. And we considered that approach from where we considered where we were after the storm, we considered that approach or that area to be the Achilles heel of the system for us. We want to get that in place.
So can you give us a little bit more detail on the construction of this barrier? What does it look like and what's the material? What materials are used?
Sure. What we did was, and we had a contract. We came in with and I'll talk about this later a little bit, but we had a design-build type contract and asked for proposals from industry. of how to do this based on our timelines and help us solve the problem. Use industry to help us give us really help us using techniques they had to help us solve the surge issue. And what we came up with, successful poser, what we had was basically a two-mile barrier with three gates, okay? The gates are for navigation. We got a 150-foot gate that's what we call a sector gate, and it looks like how do I explain this? It doesn't lift. It moves in the water. It opens like a couple of leaves in the water. It's kind of a circular type operation that slides around, but it opens like a couple of leaves, and the gate and it stays open most of the time, and it can be closed during a storm, used primarily for navigation. We have another gate on the other side, what we call a barge gate. It's really a concrete gate that we use mainly for keep the system open during construction, and also if we have to repair to the gate, we can open it up. But it's basically a kind of a concrete barge. We can float it in place and close and during a storm. And then we have further down the system at the other, that's up on the north side, near what we call the GIWW, or the Gulf Coast Inner Harbor Waterway. That's for that piece. And then down at the southern side of a barrier, we have a gate. It's a lift gate. Basically, it just sounds like what it is. It just, the gate itself, when it closes, it lifts straight up, but it opens up, closes down, and blocks the system. And it's mainly for recreational traffic, also for commercial shrimpers and those kind of things can use that. And it's on what we call Bayou B Avenue. It crosses there. And between two sections are it's a concrete barrier. I'm sorry, you had a question?
No, I just wanted to clarify your description of the gates. The one that, if I understand correctly, it rotates. That's for major shipping traffic?
Yes, yes. It opens kind of like a leaf on a door. It's really kind of circular. They're kind of like half moons, and they close together at the top. And what they do is they rotate open or rotate close. Actually, it stays open most of the time. Except for a storm, they stay open. And they would close in kind of like a half arch. They would close up and close the system off.
And the other gate that you described for recreational shipping, it sounds like that's a lift gate. So you couldn't pass ships through there that have a high clearance requirement.
There's a height. We designed it for the gate. The B Avenue area is limited traffic because of the depth of there. It's not a shipping channel. It's really just a commercial travel. And so you're right. It has a height limit on it. But it allows all of the width and the height allow all the commercial fishing vessels to go through that use it now.
And if I'm trying to picture this barrier, do I picture a concrete wall that is grounded somehow in the bottom of the ocean and goes up into the air? What's it look like?
Yeah, okay. The barrier itself, that's just a couple of openings. The barrier itself makes up about 10,000 feet of the basically the 2 miles across. And the barrier it's really a concrete 5.5 foot diameter concrete piles, basically cylindrical piles, that are 140 feet long and one for 144 feet long, excuse me. And we drive those into the ground. They stick up about 20 feet in the 14 feet above the 14 foot elevation, not above the water, 14 to 15 foot elevation from ground level, which would be from sea level plus 14. And we take those things and we actually fill some of those full of grout and rebar. And then we put a 200-foot, what we call a batter pile, on the protected side. If the storm's coming from the east side, on the west side, we put a diagonal batter pile. It's about 200-plus feet long. We drive it in the ground for additional stability. And then on top of that, we put a concrete cap, that takes the total elevation up to about 21 feet, 22 feet in there, and it's grouted into the top of the big 5.5 foot piles. It's got some big rebar that comes out of it that ties it together, and then it's braced off of the batter pile. And then on top of that, we put a parapet wall, so it takes the total elevation to about 26 on the protected side. You've got a massive structure, and the wall, the cap on top of this, if the front side's got 26-foot elevation, it allows for a roadbed in the back on the backside and a guardrail so that you can drive the system from one end to the other. On the back of the, when you close the gates, you can go across the gates, drive across those, all the way down the barrier to the other side of the system.
And the way you described it, if the storm is coming from the east or the west, is this something that gets set in place when a storm is approaching, or is this something that's just there all the time?
It's the barrier's there all the time. The gates would close when a storm was approaching. And this is the east side of the protection of the system. This is not the, wouldn't be a west protection. We have a, with the other end of the canal, on the north side, we have another smaller gate called the Seabrook Gate, and that takes care of the part of the west side at Lake Pontchartrain, and then the lock at on the Mississippi side of the process. So you're closing the canal now on three locations. Seabrook, when we finish it, the IHC Lake Bourne barrier, which you probably, if you look at Engineering News Record or some of the trade magazines, you'll see this pictures of that picture project, or our website would show it too. And then you have the lock of Mississippi Riverside. So that closes that canal off during a storm.
And you mentioned that you sought a design-build contract. Why was that important, and what are the advantages of doing it like that?
In this particular case, we wanted to, we had a really close, quick timeline in this process, and it was a very unique problem. These marsh, you're building it in the middle of basically a marsh area. Typical methods would take longer. We were told, a lot of people told us we couldn't get it done in the time frame we wanted, time-wise. So we wanted to work with industry to help find us a very effective, high-quality solution that we could bring into play early in the system to provide protection. One of the reasons for the barge guy I didn't talk about, we don't get to what we call 100-year protection till the end of the project, but as early as next year, we'll have significant protection for the interior of New Orleans area just from this barrier. So one of our requirements was how can we get some protection early?
The idea being that you have to get it up quickly, because if there was another disaster in New Orleans, that would just be intolerable.
That's right. The quicker we could get it up, the better off we would be. So we used industry to help us set our requirements and let them help us design and build it, so that we work very closely with them. Yes.
Can you give us a little bit more of an explanation of the design build process?
Sure. The design build, really, what it amounts to is it's used a lot in other parts of the industry. But design build, what you do normally people think of design, we call design bid build. You design something, then you go back and you bid it out, and a contractor bids on it, and he builds it for you. But you don't talk to your construction contractor until you actually put it on the street to build, okay? He gets no input in the process. In design build, you go to an entity and say, look, I want you to, here's my requirements, here are my performance needs I have, here are the parameters or my restrictions I have to get this thing done. And I want you to help. I want you to design it and build it for me to give me the performance that I need or the characteristics I need in this contract. You have a contract, but they're not drawings necessarily. They're probably more like, in this case, we had performance standards. So what we wanted to protect, when we wanted to get it done, what our costs were, where our locations were, what some of the technical parameters were. We put a lot of technical design, and they design and build the process. What makes this great is the designer and the builder work together. He may hire a designer in many cases, or they may, and the big firms may have their own house capability, but they work very closely with the constructor and suppliers as they go along to make it, to make sure that you interface a lot more, I think, more the design, with designers interface more with the construction than normal.
Well, the company that ends up doing it has a perfect understanding of the project, which in the other case, there's a lot of work that they have to try to understand what they're being asked to do.
That's right. You're right. And a lot of times, yes, you're right. They've got a better understanding what the drawing is. They understand the requirements up front. They agree to deliver, and they work with the designer to make those things happen. It's a faster process because you can start, construction before design's complete. For instance, Shaw was able to, in this case, where our design builder, they were able to start buying these precast piles. They were spiral wound piles off-site. And they were smaller sections they post-tensioned put together. And before they knew the total length they had to have, they were able to start building the sections. And so they had some of the fabrication work done while they're getting ready to start construction. and they knew they could add another 8 foot on or 10 foot on or whatever to get the total length they had to have, but they could start building the sections early. So it speeds the process up.
You think we should be using design build on all large infrastructure? Are there any risks to the approach?
Well, there are. Okay, I will tell you, in this particular case, this is a cost plus project. It was a cost plus design build project, which means the cost, we paid the cost, the government paid the cost. There was not a limit on that process. And we don't normally like to do that kind of work. This is a lot of risk or a lot of unknowns that were in this case. Typically, you want to get to the price. You can use design build more for fixed price, and it pays better dividends of certain types of projects. This project, by making it cost plus and putting emphasis on the speed, it made it good, but you don't always want to do that in all cases.
Does cost plus mean that at the end of the day, when you're all done, you just bill us for what it cost you?
Basically, not exactly. Well, you have to monitor things longer to be allowable cost, but it means that the government takes the risk of cost more than the contractor. On a fixed price contract of any type, design build or design bid build, the person with the contract you enter into gives you a price, and they must deliver for that price unless you add changes. In a cost plus contract, you must pay the allowable cost, legitimate cost for that work, and plus an award fee. The award fee is based upon certain things you ask the contractor to do. It could be how well he manages cost, time delivery, quality of the project, but you have a board that sits up and based on certain parameters, and you give the contractor his incentive or his fee or his profit basically based upon how well he does those things. And it's based on a percentage of the actual cost of the project.
So when what you're calling an award fee, it really encompasses incentives for rapid completion, for example.
That's right. We put incentives in this particular contract for rapid completion and holding to original budget, okay? And there's other factors in there, too. Safety is a factor, quality of the project, rework, you know, because we're paying our dollars. He's got to do a lot of rework because he's not got a good quality program, that kind of stuff. How well he manages the dollars itself. You know, there's going to be some growth. In a cost contract, usually you go cost because there's a lot of unknowns. People can't give you a fixed price. Or if they give you a fixed price, it's going to be very inflated and a lot of risk associated with that number that you're paying for, and you don't know what it is. So rather than just pay all that large fee because it's hard to bid, you go into a cost contract and you watch the contractor and monitor the process of how he manages your dollars, how well he comes close to budget, and how he makes his timelines.
So he's going to get his costs are going to get covered, but whatever rewards or incentives are going to depend on his performance and all the factors that you just described.
That's right. And he doesn't necessarily get more money because his costs go up. If he has legitimate changes, we have things we call fee-bearing changes and non-fee-bearing changes. In other words, if poor management, in our opinion, drives the cost up, not only does he get hurt in his award fee, we don't give him additional. His fee doesn't go up for that reason. If we add scope to the project, his fee can go up.
So he has an exposure there if you determine there's bad management. Have you run into any unexpected problems doing the barrier? And if you have, how'd you respond? Were there consequences in cost or in schedule?
Yeah, that we had. I would tell you, we knew going in, we actually did a couple of innovative things in this project. We actually awarded the contract prior to the environmental documentation being complete. We did the environmental in a two-phase operation. We did the first phase saying we know we had to have a barrier between these two locations to know what it's going to look like. In the second phase, we brought the contractor in and said we're going to have this is going to be the type of barrier we propose. We put it in our environmental process. Now, at that point in time, we knew we were going to have a couple of we've done the first phase of the environmental process, and we knew we need a couple of gates, three gates, and we need some sort of barrier, but we didn't know exactly where it's going to be located. We let him help us with that process because there's some pipelines there and some other things we had to work around. And he worked that piece. The other thing we hadn't done completely was all the navigation studies. Okay, we hadn't done all the navigation velocity studies. And we thought we'd finish this up fairly quickly, but we ran into some problems with velocities that we didn't expect. We did a lot of modeling during the design process using our designer's information on gates. We used what we call ERDEC, which is our engineering research center up in Vicksburg. And we did physical and computer models of the system. In fact, we even made a simulator, kind of like a big Wii system, basically. I don't know, might be a good example, like you might train aircraft pilots on. And we brought in navigation people from industry and our own navigation people, and had them navigate the lock and made adjustments to the design, not the lock, I'm sorry, the gate. And we made adjustments to the design of the gate and to the approach walls based on the results of this simulator.
And is this design that you've done here unique? Are there similarities between what you've done with the IHNC and surge protection systems in the Netherlands?
Yeah, it's very similar to some of the Netherlands work. It's not unique. It's a little unique to New Orleans, which they usually use a lot of either T walls or I walls or levee, or just actually building up dirt levees. It's kind of an A-frame system, very similar to some of the stuff they've done in other parts of the country. The lift gate in particular is something very prevalent in the Netherlands. We have a couple of engineers that work for that support us in consulting work from the government side. We brought in and we've done a lot of consulting with the Netherlands groups and how they in the development of this design, in the location of this design also.
Are there other infrastructure projects that are necessary to provide adequate protection for New Orleans from another big hurricane? Is this wall enough? Is there more that's needed?
Oh, yeah. We're fully funded to complete the rest of them, the first phase, the 100-year protection. Well, we've got about 300-plus miles of levee systems. We're also doing some work on the internal pump stations. People forget that New Orleans area is below sea level, and a lot of the places are. And with the levees in place, every bit of rainwater that comes in must be pumped out. So we've also doing some work on the pump stations for what we call storm-proofing. If we ever had a storm that water got back into the levee system, that these pump stations during a major hurricane storm could operate through, wouldn't be shut down because of lack of power or lack of people. That's the first phase we're working now. But further on, the metropolitan area has a lot of other things they need to do. One of those being environmental restoration of a lot of the wetlands and marshlands and the cypress swamps. I mean, there's been a lot of degradation since the 20s and 30s and not much buildup of these areas. And there's a lot of work and planning going in right now between the federal government and the state government on how to bring these areas back, because cypress swamps and marsh areas have a certain amount of surge and storm protection. And they need to bring those back. Okay. And interior, that there are things they can do. The city's looking at different projects of how you might compartmentalize if you had an area that flooded, much like the Dutch do, or much like a ship may do. If one area of the ship floods, they could compartmentalize it so it only stayed one area. In the city itself, the federal government's not involved in that, but I should say the city. The local levee authorities, really, are looking at different ways they might do that. So there's a lot of work, after you get the first initial, what we call 100-year protection, or 1% probability of overtopping of any given year. Once that levee system's in place, there are other things for longer term and for increased benefit that need to be done or will be done.
So when will the primary work by the Corps of Engineers be done?
The system itself, the basic infrastructure system we're doing now for the 100-year protection, will be done. Protection will be in place by 1 June. There'll still be construction going on, but 1 June 2011. Now, we'll probably won't finish the secondary work till later. Plus, we have some other projects, follow-on projects, part of this system that won't be done to 2012 or 14. For instance, we have some outfall canals along the metro area where we have an interim control structure in place that allows us to protect the system for 100-year protection by 2011. But we're going to put a permanent system in, and that will be complete to about 2014.
And I have in the bio here that you're the chief of program execution for the project. How many people does that mean you're overseeing? That sounds like a big job, a big role.
Well, it is a big job. Between contract, now not construction contractors, but my support staff here is a little over 300 people. Plus, guys, we don't have an engineering organization per se. We got a small engineering group here. So we reach back to our other districts. We have what we call the Mississippi Valley Division, which has districts all along the Mississippi River, all the way from St. Paul down to Vicksburg. And we use all those districts in engineering support and other support. plus we're using some groups out of the Northwest Division, Portland areas, to help us with some of our pumps. And we get some support from Chicago Chicago is, I think, got a sister district. Chicago and Detroit, I believe, to do support on some other projects. So we got a national support program. But here on the ground, managing construction and design, about 300 people.
You know everybody's name?
Yeah, friend.
Hello, friend.
Yeah.
This is a very impressive and important project, and we appreciate the fact that you've given us a very thorough description of it. It's obviously critically important to protect a historic city that's of high value to not only the people there, but to the nation. So we appreciate the time that you've spent in bringing us up to speed on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot.